You're listening to More Than This, the podcast where Christian faith and reason explore reasons for Christian faith.
Life's not a sequence programmed from the sky, but it's a story woven up and down, in and out, like the stitches in a...
If you enjoy our show, please consider supporting us for as little as $1 a month on Patreon. Check out our site at www.patreon.com/morethanthispod. Thank you.
It's possible to hear someone say in the same conversation that everything is relative, but also go on to say something that sounds absolute, like everything happens for a reason. We live in a time where people balk at absolutes. But why? This episode is called Relatively Certain, and we are talking about certainty, relativism, and absolutes. Enjoy.
Hello, welcome to More Than This. This week, I'm pretty excited about this topic, Kate. We're a little at odds about all the places we could go with this one, I think.
I think I'm going to be out of my league. Just you might be on a different plane of thought than I am, but I'm going to try to hang in there with you, Dave.
I'm sure we'll all be fine. We'll all do well. We'll all get an achievement trophy or a participation trophy at the end. It'll be great.
By all, I think you mean you, but anyways, go ahead. What are we talking about, Dave?
Today, we're talking about the concept of absolutes.
No pithy title?
This one's called Relatively Certain.
I knew it. I knew there was something.
So the idea of relativism, certainty, absolutes. And this episode, I can't take credit, was inspired by good friends of mine, Christy and James. So thank you guys for the idea.
Apologies in advance for how I will butcher your idea.
Oh, it'll be fine. So we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to go a couple different directions. So we're going to talk about the idea of absolutes. So, Kate, we live, I think, in a culture that is sort of overcome by relativism. And I'm not necessarily wringing my hands about this, but I'll explain what I mean by that and kind of denies the possibility of absolutes.
So I agree. So far, I'm tracking with you.
You're with me so far? So you've probably incurred the idea of relativism, at least cultural relativism, personal relativism, in that, you know, the sort of thing that rules the day is somebody will say, well, you know, whatever somebody believes is fine, that's up to them. It's not my business. It's their thing. And at the bottom of a lot of this is sort of the underlying belief that there's no way to sort of mediate or arbitrate what's true anyway. There's no such thing as universal truth. There's only truths that are available for individual people. So you kind of say your beliefs are what's true for you, and the next person, what's true for you, and none of that truth really transcends or has bearing on any other person. So the idea of absolutes or universals is the opposite of that, kind of, that there is a reality that may be bigger than your idea to sort of get it or believe it, or it doesn't really depend on you believing it. It's just true, right? So we sit in a place with Christian faith where we profess certain things that you kind of are required to believe to wear the name Christian, right? Now, there's a lot of different expressions about that. You know, different Christian traditions say some things are sort of universal or necessary, and other, you know, traditions get rid of those or have a different set. So we're going to talk about some of that today. But it's really interesting because I think a lot of where we've landed in our society is that the de facto sort of moral viewpoint is relativism, where it's just like, well, I can't possibly impose my values on somebody else. All of that sounds well and good, but it presumes that there is no ultimate reality that is binding on everybody, and that everything is up for sort of self-determination, self-interpretation, and, you know, whatever your own perspective is, like where you sit.
So I'm not a historian, but I hang out with some sometimes.
And you said they all sound alike.
Yes, they do. Whenever I hear historians on podcasts, they kind of sound similar to me or have a similar way of talking. But I had a historian friend who often talked about, like, you know, postmodernism. So do you think that this also relates to relativism, right? This postmodern idea that I mean, postmodernism essentially says that things are relative, right? That we can't.
Yes. This was a feature, absolutes were more a feature of modernism, which is sort of the period that kind of came before postmodernism out of the Enlightenment.
I like how you was, that was really, it's like when you guess that something was said by Paul in the Bible, you're like, and modernism came before postmodernism, but then you had a light enlightenment before it. So that showed that you knew something more than just that modernism came before postmodernism.
That's true. But these are all really broad swath generalizations, but postmodernism in its essence is sort of that there is, they don't, you know, it was rejecting of sort of universal narratives, that there's like one sort of overarching story that we can all fit and find meaning in. It's all just a collection of stories and often competing stories. So there's a big focus on power, sometimes about who has the will and power to enforce their story over somebody else's, but we're all just a collection of competing smaller stories, and that's okay. So it's really, really interesting.
And so Christians, speaking to like what the contours of this debate are, like maybe within Christianity, Christians are swimming in that broader sea of culture and these like broader movements. And so do you, I feel like maybe there's been some adaptation or some accommodation, except really what happens then is that sometimes people, if there's the fear is that if you have acceptance or accommodation of some of these broader, particularly with postmodernism, you move away from like the core of Christianity because you become less able to say there is an absolute truth. Because again, to your point, that is a basis of, I mean, most, I don't want to speak for all religions, but at their core, my understanding of most religions is they do have a belief in absolute, like Buddhists believe that like, no, you are going to get reincarnated.
At their core, there's a core?
Yes, exactly. That's a good way of saying it, Dave. There's a there there.
There's a there there. Yeah, and you'll hear this a lot. And I will say particularly in evangelical circles, accommodation to the world, giving in to sort of, you know, the death of truth. You know, people are like, oh, there is absolute truth. And, you know, kind of at war with postmodern thinking. Some strains of the church have been caught up in that and have a real hard time. However, I would say the pushback would be, I don't know if they could always articulate a coherent, compelling Christian grand narrative either, like a grand story of Christianity that sort of encompasses and accounts for all of what we see in the world around us, like sort of understanding that. So, but you do hear that a lot, right? Like, oh, you're giving into the world, or, you know, these people say there's no truth and I know the truth. But it's often the denomination you go to, right? So you're claiming things as universal, which are actually kind of niche to your own practicing community of faith.
And I guess this is where, when we were kind of thinking through this episode together, we had a little bit of a difference. I think you were really happy to play in like the big questions, metaphysical sort of space about what's true, absolutes, and I was like, oh, I thought we were going to talk about what are the absolutes of Christianity? Like, what would we say that we have to hold on to or we cease to? Like, by definition, is there a definition of Christianity? I'm not even talking necessarily about evangelicalism here. I'm just saying, if you're going to say I'm a Christian, what are the things that would define, what are the things that you would agree to or, you know, say that you believe?
And this is really interesting. I love the fact that we differ on this because both of them are really essential conversations. And what we're trying to do is kind of put them together. So Kate already sort of hinted at it. What does it mean to express a faith that has some sort of exclusive claims or universal claims? Like Christians don't say that, you know, Jesus was sent to earth and God is a Trinity and Jesus was born of a virgin and it was crucified and raised again and offers salvation for anyone who believes and whatever else, you know, people sort of consider core, but that's only binding on the people who go to First Baptist Church, right? That spreads out and that covers the whole world, right? And other religions have their own version of that that may differ or, you know, radically differ. And it's not just like, well, I'm Muslim, but that as a Muslim, I believe that's just for me. Like, no, like this extends to society, extends to the world around us as well. And postmodernism has tried to sort of cut off conflict. I think there's something admirable in it and saying, let's put everybody on equal footing and offer equal dignity, but we also then just say we all believe the same thing and inherently everything's worth the same. And it accords, basically in saying that, it's like, we can't really say what reality's like. So the biggest reality is that we create our own reality. There's no reality. So all of these things, like, if you believe in something, like we have theological beliefs that we hold near and dear and we espouse to be true, it's logically, it doesn't make sense to me to be like, you know what, that's, you know, everybody else is exempt from that. It's just my own personally deeply held conviction. That's not the nature of what we're saying, right?
And I wonder if the point, to touch on what you said about the admirable part of postmodernism, might have been to say, you don't have to wipe out people. People don't have to be a threat to you if they don't believe the same thing, or like, we have to find a kumbaya way to live together. That might have been part of the impulse. And I wonder if it's possible, maybe the real question here is, how do you hold to absolute beliefs, but still live in a world, even if you think those absolutes apply, or like there's ultimate absolute truth, it's not relative, it is the truth. If you believe that, how do you live in a world peacefully and respectfully with others who don't hold those beliefs, right? Or who are...
And how do you allow for individual differences in personality and expression and culture? You know what I mean? Like, and not... I think some of the times we make the universals get very particular. Right? You're like, okay, now this means you have to, because we believe that God came down, you know, in the form of a man, lived for this, you know, whatever amount of time, was, you know, crucified, beat sin in the grave. You have to wear a long skirt. You know what I mean? Like, you can't wear makeup, or
you will cover your hair.
You will cover your hair, or, you know, men will, you know, go be breadwinners and women will, you know. Whatever you can make that really particular, and those seem really non-essential. So I think that's what happened. Historically, looking at absolutes can lead to absolutism, where you just sort of like, you can rule with an iron fist and sort of like, I'm going to use a word, like head hegemony. Like, you can hegemonically, which is just sort of like brute strength, power, like running your worldview. Actually, worldview is a fraught term. I won't use that.
But I like that you used fraught that way.
I did. I know. I'm trying to accommodate Kate.
I like the word fraught, and Dave used to think he couldn't use it the way he just did, but he's learning from me. Go ahead, Dave. You would rule with an iron fist.
Yeah, like you just sort of, it's an imperialist tendency. So.
Like the Crusades type thing?
Yeah, there's got to be a different way of, you know, holding universals, but not making them so particular to not allow for difference or disagreement. Because it seemed like a good thing. You know, it was a good corrective to sort of cultural relativism. Franz Boas was sort of named as one of the progenitors of the cultural relativism movement, where cultures were just different. They weren't right or wrong. They're all just sort of, you know, different expressions. But I think even then we could talk about some sort of universals of human flourishing that most people, if they were offered in a society, would want to have. And whether different cultural expressions tend to lead people more or less toward outcomes that they would probably want if they were available, right? Because in doing this, you know, and sort of saying every culture is fine, everybody does this, everybody's that, some of the, what we've been unable to do is then turn around and say, oh, but we have to then be okay with the outcomes of your culture, right? Your culture mistreats women. Well, it's just a different cultural expression. You kind of can't have it both ways. You know what I mean? Like, you can't be like, oh, it's okay that this society is this way or this culture is this way, even though it seems to violate a universal or oppress a certain group or whatever. You're on weird ground. You're on weird philosophical and logical ground to sort of hold both without saying maybe there are some universals, without sliding all the way back into being like that absolutist, like, we're just going to run roughshod over you and take all the power away. Because absolutism, as we're seeing now, you can be a relativist and push that on people as well, right? You can totally push it on people as well. You can see it in Hollywood. You see it with cancel culture, right? Where students are like running faculty out of like universities, things like that. So by saying that everybody, it doesn't, people are sometimes personally, they're relativist in terms of society, but they don't hold their views that way, right? They're very much like fixed. Like, I know what's best for me. I know what's true. And I think the point of it is, I think part of how we're designed is that we, in order to make meaning, our truth that we subscribe to has to be bigger than us, or else it doesn't provide any meaning. That's my thought. Kate, discuss. It got real heavy. You want me to say hegemony like five more times?
Say it's fraught.
Fraught.
No, I was just thinking about... you got a little heady there for me, Dave.
I know.
I'm
a fart joke here soon if you want me to.
No, I'm trying to think about how this conversation about absolutes, how I've heard it talked about. I think we've touched on that a little bit so far. But how we grew up with it, and I don't know how you grew up with the concept of absolutes. But I grew up, and this is kind of like should play a little violin. Is that what you do when you're playing a repeating story? No, I can't remember this is a story I think you and I have told before in different ways when we've spoken on this podcast, that we were sort of cautioned against losing that core, or like there is this idea of the slippery slope and you've got to hold to these absolutes, right?
Oh, like, yeah. One of my favorite Christian arguments, slippery slope.
Oh, yeah. Slippery slope is like to folks who may not have heard it, the idea is...
if you make one concession, it's just like in a rabbit trail, and suddenly you'll just fall all the way into an abyss of meaninglessness.
Exactly. You'll just lose. You'll be completely untethered. You'll lose your faith completely. And so I think within this stew of like postmodernism and relativism, in which we, you know, both of us, that's mostly where we were when we were raised. That's kind of what was in the ether in the broader culture. I think that there was a tendency among evangelicals to sort of clamp down on those core, like, absolute beliefs. In a way, I understand that impulse, but I also think it's a little bit scary, or it makes it scary to ever think any other thoughts, or to ever entertain anything else. And then you kind of get stuck in a cage where you can't even contemplate. Like, if you want to make something your own, if you grew up with a belief and you want to make it your own, you kind of want to test it out, look at some other things. And I think there's an impulse within Christianity and evangelicalism in America in particular to not want to have people have that freedom because they're afraid that they'll lose you. But did they ever really have you if you couldn't step, you know, if you could never step outside the lines and come back in on your own? Were you ever really of your own volition within those lines?
And faith and certainty were equated, right?
Yes.
So if you taught things that are 100% certain, and you give, the more universals you give, it can, there's sort of a sweet spot, right? If you give too many universal things that you have to hold on to and believe, if you ratchet those number up, the world can seem more predictable and certain and transactional, right? You can kind of get into a space where if something happens, like, you can account for it, like, oh, well, the world operates this way, so if this happens, this means God is judging somebody. I remember, sounds a little far afield, but somebody in my family mentioned during LA, Los Angeles was having mudslides one time, as they're prone to do, and they happened really close to where my brother was living. And you know, somebody said, well, that's just God's judgment on the Hollywood lifestyle. My brother's like, I live there. Like, I was like right by my house. Like, I almost like wiped out our apartment we lived in. Like, what are you talking about? Like, there's just this like one-to-one correlation. Like, we know how the God works and the world works. And it's like more universals than you need. So that you're sold with certainty, and that gives you predictability and comfort. And it all sounds good. But then once you start questioning that, you've given too many universals and they don't all work, right?
Yeah. Just to throw two more examples. I mean, these are more famous ones, but like the Pat Roberts, is it Robertson or Roberts? Pat Roberts? What's the guy?
Pat Robertson. You're thinking of Oral Roberts and Pat Robertson.
Oh, look at you. You know, you're just evangelical history so well, you knew who I was confusing. So it's Pat Robertson.
Yes.
Okay. On the Christian Broadcasting Network, he's this
700 Club guy.
Yes. And after 9/11, there was, he said, oh, this was God's wrath on, you know, New York City for all the evils that go on in New York City. And then I remember after the earthquake in Haiti, he made a comment that, oh, well, this, you know, we know why this earthquake happened. It's because Haiti gave itself over to Satan through
witchcraft,
voodoo. Yeah.
Voodoo.
Even another, just to pull out another example, John Piper, after there was was it a tornado or a bridge that collapsed? Maybe a tornado made a bridge collapse. I could be making up that calamity. But this happened, I don't know, maybe a decade ago in Minneapolis, and it was right after a denomination, I think, I don't know, some denomination had voted to ordain LGBTQ pastors and to have allow people to be married. And John Piper was like, see, I mean, he like had a tweet out that was like, see, look, this is God's wrath on, you know, because they made this decision. That's why this happened. And you kind of just want to scratch your head and say, really? Like, and these are not like small fit. I mean, I'm just trying to point out, Dave, it's not just some random person in your church who got their theology off. These are like kind of major figures. And I just want to say, I mean, that's, first of all, I think that's completely ridiculous. The Bible doesn't allow us to, it's like when they used to predict end times and then it didn't work out and things like that, right?
Like, oh yeah. Like, Lord's coming in 1988, or, you know, people going out and waiting on rooftops and robes and things like that. And yeah.
So, and coming back to this idea of certainty though, and things, there's that, that Pete End's book, The Sin of Certainty, where he's basically saying we have made sort of the correct elucidation of those precise beliefs, right? Or like the correct beliefs, sort of an idol in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And right. We've done that because we've taken things from the Bible. And I am very open to that argument, but I'm going to be really honest. It also does make my evangelical soul a little bit nervous because I start to think, well, what am I holding on to, right? Like, what is the anchor here?
I think this is interesting. No, it's true. I think, you know, what I had started to say was that as I'm wrestling through this too, I think it's possible that we gave, you know, we made too many things universal that weren't really universal, right? To aid certainty, because the more universal you have, the more certain you can sound, and the more transactional the world becomes, and the more safe it feels, less mystery there is. And this historically makes sense too, because we were trying to eliminate all mystery, right? This was the idea of the Enlightenment, and we're going to solve everything with science. Everything was going to be reduced to sort of universal laws and principles. And this was the backlash that, you know, relativism and postmodernism kind of came out of. So it's usually abuses at either end, right, that make the pendulum swing. So it probably was a good thing to sort of say, you know, the world is relational. Everybody has a perspective based on where they sit, and what they see and what they comprehend is going to be different than somebody who sits and has a different perspective, different age, different culture, different gender, whatever it is. Those things are all true. And for a long time, that sounds common sense to us now. But there was a whole idea in social sciences that Kate and I both didn't get our doctorate in. Hers political science, mine sociology. There used to be the myth of objectivity, right? That you could sort of be value-free and perspective-free and sort of have a just true, unadulterated view of what was going on. And that's been kind of debunked. But it doesn't mean that you have to go to the other side where it's like there's no truth at all. But I think some of the way our theological systems are set up, like there's still that old school where it's like just too many universals for their own good. Like just to try to iron out all the mystery out of life, make it totally predictable, which again doesn't sound like faith to me. At the end of the day.
And I think that's the corollary, again, coming back to that kind of that thesis, sort of the thesis that's been, I think, in a couple of his recent books with Pete Enns has been, you're taking faith out of the perspective completely. If you make certainty the idol, then you've taken, what does faith even mean? And I'm still trying to work that out. Like, okay, let me take a step back. And I'm going to kind of pose a question to myself and then answer it. And that would be, as we were preparing for this, I was thinking, where am I in the sense of what I think are absolute truths, not just for me, but like facts or things that exist, right? Like things that I feel certain about. And I've talked to you before, Dave, about the process I had recently of trying to join and then being not allowed to join a church. I still go to this church, but that's a whole other story. I was like really honest about all my beliefs, and they were like, oh, actually, we're not going to condone you, and you go on a podcast and talk about these beliefs, so we kind of especially don't want you representing us. But in any case, it was helpful. It was a helpful exercise for me, because what I essentially said to them was like, look, the older I've gotten, there are many things of which I am less certain, but the universe of things about which I am very certain has gotten smaller and much, much deeper. And I think that this is going to sound like such a kind of wishy-washy answer, but I don't really think that it is. It comes down to Jesus, who he was, what he did, and what that means for the overall redemptive story of all history and of the world. And even though that might seem like a pretty narrow set of beliefs, I think that still I have other friends who are like, that's crazy that you're that certain that like Jesus was the Son of God. He lived, he died, he has a redemptive plan for the entire world. You're invited into relationship. You know, there's a bunch of beliefs that are in there. And that's sort of what I was offering to this church. I was saying, look, like we agree on like what I see as being the core of Christian faith, what defines us as being a Christian. Therefore, I think I'm one of you. And it was interesting. The response was, actually, because we had all these other things we said were non-essentials, but since you don't agree with us on those, you're actually not in you can't be in our club, right? Like we don't really belong to the same group, but you know, you can keep coming here.
You can keep coming here.
Well, that's like a whole other conversation for another time. But I don't know, Dave, do you feel like do you think that's a useful, again, being not a particularly, I don't want to make myself sound dumb, but being not a particularly philosophical person. I mean, I don't enjoy thinking in the realm of like metaphysics and all of those things.
I've heard you used to fall asleep in your philosophy class.
Yes, I did. That's like the only class in my entire life that I ever struggled to stay awake in. I'm like, I live in this world and I want to know there has to be a there. I think I also explained it to you as saying, look, there's a play of reality going on, and there's a core set of characters that are acting out this play. That core set of characters is always the same for me. Some supporting cast comes in and out, and that might change, and it changes the tenor and the feel, but there's still like a core. There's a there.
I think that's right, and I think that I am, I'll say this with fear and trembling. I guess I'm a critical realist philosophically. I do believe.
Explain that to me, critical realist, Dave. Remember sleeping in the philosophy class?
Real low level where I understand it is the idea that there's a reality that's independent of our senses. And the critical part is that we can critique the nature of it and sort of apprehend it more or less. And have a bunch of different disciplines, you know, in the university or in society that sort of like weigh in and look at different aspects of what's real. But, you know, we're always at best just sort of describing it and trying to put a container around it. We can't really grasp it and manipulate it and know it fully, but it's still there. It's not just all socially constructed. There's a reality that's beyond our ability to sort of make it up. And being that I feel that way, it means that, yeah, I kind of agree with you that there's something there that I may have apprehended reality. Basically, the idea is that reality will hit you in the head sometimes. You know, you might be delusional and think all is well and everybody's flourishing, but like you're really not doing well, or you go through a divorce, or you know, like whatever, like somebody leaves you or think your job fires you, you thought you were doing great. These are silly, you know, sort of not silly examples, but ways that we can, our constructed reality and our understanding of reality don't match full reality, right? Like, I think my marriage is going well, but it's actually not. And I think my body's doing well and it's full of cancer. And I think my job performance is going well, but it's not. And I got laid off or fired. Like, the world is kind of that way. And I see tenets of faith that way as well, where I had so many universals that I had to be, that had to be true, and so many things that sort of simplified my life, but it also made them very complicated at the same time. Things I had to kind of keep up with. I let some of those go, but I think some of them are kind of coming back to me, because maybe people, like, you can get sort of like petulant and cross your arms, be like, I don't want to believe that. Like, that doesn't seem right, so I'm not going to believe it. If it's real, independent of your desire to believe it or not, you're still subject to it, right? So this is where things go. You can look at things like cultural absolutes. I just read a book that, or a guy actually has gone around and found cultural absolutes that transpire across history, that you know, go across cultures, across history, that sort of seem to be universal features of societies. The world sort of seems to be run in some part by universals. It doesn't mean that you have to be an asshole about everything and, you know, force your beliefs on everybody else. But I think there is something there where there might be something universal and real that's binding on you, whether you believe it or not. And that's kind of how I view faith. Have we created a bunch of mechanisms and doctrine that might be too far and maybe sort of a misguided effort to make the world really predictable or to control people? Sure. But I do hold to things more clearly and dearly now, like you said, coming around back to your question. And I think they do matter. And I think how you hold them is a lot different. Like you said, maybe, you know, you have less things, but you hold on to them more dearly, but you're probably not a jerk about them, right? You've probably learned to hold them differently, right? And engage the world around you differently and bring people into your life differently, right? I think that's kind of separate, right? But it's also kind of smushed together.
Yeah, I think that I have also learned to accept that, like, I don't understand gravity, but I'm still subject to it. Like, it doesn't make sense on, like, right? Like,
that's a good example.
Yeah. Like, I can believe gravity's not true, but when I jump up, I'm going to come down, right? So there's certain observable things. And that's where I think this, Dave, we've talked about this a little bit before. It's not, like, the main thing we're talking about today, obviously, but there are, you know, the idea of, like, miracles or things that can help with belief because they... things that that should not have happened or that seem miraculous, or a way that God could maybe enter into the world, that, like, where the exception proves the rule, sort of, right? And I think I've had, I won't go into detail, but I think I've had some of those experiences in my life. But even without those, there are still these things that I believe to be absolutely true. And there is an element. And I've talked to one of my, a dear friend of mine, Beth, if you're listening, this is based on conversations with you, where she's like, I'm just still stuck at the point that you believe that God exists and that there's these absolute truths, right? Like, how do you get there? And I really thought about that. And I thought, you know, I do believe them, but it kind of, and that's how I'm orienting my life around these core beliefs, these things that I believe are absolutely true. But what's the worst? I mean, I can be realistic. What's the worst case scenario if they're not true? I don't know that I've, I mean, that sounds, I don't think evangelicals would typically like that. It's almost like, but I'm like, let's
like
just
a pragmatic view. Like,
yeah.
Is the world a worse place or a better place for me having held these beliefs?
Exactly. And it's interesting because her perspective is, well, I would only hold the beliefs, or I'm only... would hold the beliefs in so much as they help me make the world a better place. But then I thought, well, that's subjective, because what's better to some people is not better to others.
And this is interesting because it gets to the point where relativism has not just become a way to see the world, but it's become a moral ethic. So it's now considered you're a good or bad person based on how relativistic you are and how you hold the idea, you sort of spurn the idea of truth. That's sort of taken on a pretty serious moral weight. So it gets to the heart of your question that maybe you were wrestling with Beth.
Yeah.
Is on its face, the belief in absolutes or being relative is seen as the morally superior position and intellectually superior as well.
And also, I think that you have to figure out what is it that you're ascribing to it. I don't know that all types of humanism get you to the same end. There could be disagreement there. So I think there could be some
argument. Nazism was very much a humanistic strategy, and I don't think we were too high on it.
Right. It's like we've sort of, you know, that this, that our moral code, I also don't buy this belief, like, I don't know, Dave, this gets more into like kind of some things about how you think the world is going to end, I guess. But there's some people who think like, oh, we're going to, there was like a strain of Christian thought, which was we're evolving and we're continually, we're progressive and things are getting better. And eventually the kingdom of, you know, we're going to make everything better on this earth. And I think that notion has been disabused, genocide after genocide after, you know, things that we've inflicted on each other. And then there's sort of another philosophy that is, you know, things are just getting worse and worse. I think it's somewhere in the middle. Like we always, human beings, we have always had the capacity to do horrible and wonderful things. I get really annoyed when people talk about, you know, like the old times, they were so good and now things are going downhill. I'm like, you realize that every generation thinks that, right? Like every generation looks back fondly on the good old days for the most part, right? Like they always think culture is getting worse. So I guess I'm saying within, I think that we're just always a mixed bag. We're doing good things and we're doing bad things. And I don't know, out of that mixed bag, what would you point to as total advancement? Like you could say, well, we've made advances in civil rights, but at the same time, I'm just using modern examples, there's a horrible civil war going on in Syria where like, how could you say we're making modern progress?
As relativism has progressed and become more of this moral core ethic, generations now, I mean, the ones that have been raised with it the most, depression and anxiety are rampant. Meaning making is a real problem now. If everybody's meaning structure is individualized and self-determined, it's kind of hard to find your place in the world in any way that sort of has like existential teeth. Like you really feel like you have a place, you know? It's all great to talk about carving out your own identity, but if you're the one that's carving it out, it's as thin as your ability to hold it, right? It's very interesting. So Kate, how do we talk about and hold on to absolutes in a culture that doesn't like them without being an asshole, I guess I'll say? Should we keep holding tightly to the idea of some absolutes? Are we saying there are absolutes?
Yes and yes to the last two questions. I still hold to them. I still believe they exist, and I'm not going to give that up. But this is where I come back to, oh, what's that? This is a word that's real popular right now, to be winsome, right? That's like a really popular word, being winsome, which I think is being like kind and convincing.
That's a Krista Tippett word from On Being, who I love. But like, yes, yes.
To be winsome. Well, I think for me, when it comes down to it, I've actually found for like in conversations with lots of close friends that I have who don't believe in my absolutes, I'm not offended that they don't believe my absolute. So it doesn't really make sense to me that I'm also not trying to like create a theocracy, which I think is the problem. Yes. That happens sometimes. People are like, well, I believe this absolute, therefore I need to make sure that everybody, you know, that this is enshrined in law. And I think that for me, this is going to sound real simple and maybe even a little cheesy, but
You just used the word theocracy, so you're fine.
Okay. I believe that if I'm coming back to saying that my absolutes are Jesus and that's like the core of my teaching, I don't think anyone in the world is going to get really angry with me if I actually emulate Jesus's life and what we're called to do in the Gospels. If I actually did that, are people going to hate me or be offended because I believe that Jesus really lived and all those things? They might say, well, I disagree with where you think what's going to happen in the afterlife for different people maybe, but how can I disagree with the fact that you're treating me really kindly and well and with respect and decency in this life?
They may not love it if you espouse all his teachings. I mean, if you read the Gospels, there's some stuff that's pretty offensive to modern sensibilities. I mean, it's not like Jesus is just, you know, I'm with you, I think, but like, I think we tend to forget some of the hard things in Jesus's teaching as well. So, you know, he doesn't sound like an a-hole, but he sounded like an a-hole to people probably back then, I'm guessing.
Okay, yes, but insofar, I think what he sounded like an a-hole to people, I love that you used, a-hole is a real common word with me, folks. That's why I'm like glad that Dave is using it. It's a term of endearment.
But you, for the record, you said nobody would be angry with you, and I think that's not a Christian metric. Like,
I would treat people with decency and respect. How's that? Not that people wouldn't be angry with me, but I think I would be well served if I actually followed. It's like that whole Gandhi saying, like, I don't like Christians, but I really like your Christ.
Right.
Yeah. I think for the most part, I think what who Jesus was offending at that time is he was upending the political reality or the power holders. So in that sense, you're right. It would be, but then would I really care if I was offending? Like, I don't know, if I'm Dietrich Bonhoeffer and I'm pissing the Nazis off, I'm not losing sleep over that.
Well, now you're pissing off either the progressive left or the radical right.
All right, Dave. So I did not wrap this up into a nice solution. You go for it, Dave. How are you going to hold the absolutes and not tick anybody off? I'd like to hear it.
Oh, I didn't. That was never part of the question. Not tick anybody off. I just think that's not a worthy goal. I think your little Wisconsin heart would love it if you
Wisconsin nice.
Yeah, that's like a high Christian virtue for you, is never offending anybody, and for me as well. I'm a people pleaser, but I think that the idea of absolutes, especially as we hold them in a culture that prefers relativism, is offensive on its face. This is your conversation with your friend. Like, it is offensive to think that anybody holds to anything universally because it could offend someone, right? So on its face, we are offensive to pure relativists, even though we are hold things loosely. And I think I sit somewhere in the middle. I obviously believe in relationality. Like, I think that everything is related and perspective matters and all of these things matter. I just think that there is something real. I want to have the humility to not claim that I know it, but I'm pursuing something that is real, right? It's not just constructed. And I think I can know more or less of it. And I can encounter God, and I can encounter the veracity of some of the universals. I think some of what we've encountered is maybe just that they don't hold up, right? Some of those universals just don't hold up. And it's not just cultural accommodation. It's like, you build a bridge too far of certainty, right? You built your theological framework a little too thin over a canyon. And if you put any weight on it, it falls apart. And like what I hear you doing, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, is like, you're going back to where that bridge is more strong, right? Like the base of Christ and the base of, you know, the reality of Jesus and his work and all those things, like that seems like that can hold a lot more and have held a lot more as you've had loss and friends have had loss and you've had to sort of sit with people and sit with your own thoughts and confusion. So I guess I'm saying I'm not going to give in either or. I don't want to go back to like 1890 and be like thoroughgoingly like absolutes guy. Everything can be found in a law and we can just explain everything. But I'm trying to hold in the middle. I think the idea that everybody has a perspective and we should hear it and it's valid and that they hold it is one thing, but the idea as a therapist, even, that everybody's strategies are going to equally get them where they want to go in terms of human flourishing is nonsense.
And you can, again, value the person and not give equal value to the thought, right? Like, it doesn't have to diminish somebody's personhood. Like, I'm giving more weight. If you're a theoretical mathematician, I'm giving a lot more weight to your thoughts on theoretical mathematics than I am to my basic algebra skills or whatever, right?
The problem is when you, in a relativistic world and individualistic world, when you come to conflate what you think about the world as being the same as who you are, people say, you're not caring for me if you don't care for my viewpoint. If you don't believe my viewpoint, that's the same as me and rejecting me. And that gets tricky, right?
And that's where I think maybe where I was trying to go with, you could disagree with what someone or not accept what someone believes, but still show them a lot of love or have a relationship and like love with that person, which in the end, at the end of the day, you're right. You're probably still going to offend people, but I still think you're going to, even if for some reason your absolutes weren't true. I think if you follow, you know, the path of Jesus or try to follow that, you're going to live a life. I think that aligns, and this is, we could talk sometime else about like natural law or some of those things, but there's a lot of things that just align that probably just lead to, I think, a good life. And I don't know if this is a cop out, Dave, but where I come at, I love that analogy you just had of the bridge. I also say the things out there in that canyon, I'm willing to look at them, explore, think about it. But I'm also willing to live with I have a much higher tolerance for unknowns and mystery in my life at this stage. At age 38, I have much more of a tolerance for that than I did at age 19. Yes. And I also have I almost feel like it's a for me to say, if I don't want God to be completely understandable and digestible into my finite brain, because then that would make God, if I could fit an infinite God into my finite brain, that would, that those two things just don't go together. So I'm happy to leave some of that infiniteness out there in that mystery canyon.
I think part of this is getting into my stretches now as we're running toward the end of our time. I think part of why we started this podcast even is to talk to people who have fallen into that canyon, to stretch this metaphor, and they feel like the bridge that was holding them up was God instead of just something man-made that was derived from sort of Christian theology. And that's the problem. When these things fail us, we think God has let us down, and it's maybe bad doctrine. It's maybe, you know, someone who is overextending universals or, you know, something. And one of the things I think that maybe not even a stretch for me, it's a stretch to maybe do it well, is I think church hurt is real. And I think people really need to have the opportunity to see that it, maybe it isn't God who's left them down at all. It's either the church or doctrine that they were told to put a lot of weight on and would explain the world. And when it didn't work out that way, the backlash was they felt like God couldn't be trusted, or God wasn't real, or God was, you know, supposed to be safe and tame and make life predictable. But God doesn't do that, even though their doctrine tried to in the name of God.
So what is the stretch to try to?
To work with people to sort of deal with my own stuff, and then also to sort of help parse that out with them. And you know, I mean, we're still here. You know, I'm still a Christian. Like, I profess to be a Christian, and with all the asterisks, and, you know, I'm not certain of fewer things, like you said, but I still feel a compelling call to live out the Christian story and talk to people about the hope of Jesus, you know, not in a conversionary way, but in almost like a side by side sort of way, like, well,
this is hope, where I am.
This is where I find hope.
Yeah. I think for me, part of my, and you could probably sense there's a little bit of angst or bitterness or something about my current church community. I think maybe for me,
come on, Kate, you're still allowed to be a friend of the church, right?
Yes, I can be a friend of the church. I'm a friend of the church. I think for me, it's really going to take digging deep and saying, how do I live this out and say, okay, we really don't have to agree on everything. Like, I think that that's something that could be pretty valuable to say, look, like, I'm still here. I'm still with you. I believe this core of things, but this is what it looks like to have. I don't say deeper, because that makes it seem like I'm saying I'm higher than them, and that's not at all what I mean. But to say, like, how do you live in community with people? This is just like a good life exercise. We share these fundamental. By the way, I have a friend who's Protestant who's trying to. His fiance is Catholic. Oh my word, Dave, it's really hard. I'm like, wow, there's like 90% agreement here. And it is, I understand there's cultural things, but it's kind of like looking at that from the outside. I'm like, you believe like the same, so much of the core there is the same. So if I can look at that situation and be like, why can't the Protestant and Catholic Church just get it together for people to get married without all this conflict? I think it's a similar thing for me to be in my church community to say, okay, it's actually for me, you're saying you're trying to have grace for the people who've fallen away. I'm actually with the people who I think are putting more universals. So how do I live in that community well and honestly without accepting all the other add-ons and model that?
That's good.
Well,
so Kate, let's just wrap for a quick second. How do you feel about this episode when we started at odds? How do you feel like it came together okay?
I still think there's large sections of it I didn't completely understand. So if you feel a little bit lost, my brother listens, by the way, Dave, and he was like, sometimes it's a little bit above my pay grade, or it's a little intellectual, but I like when you're funny. So guys, hopefully I brought some pizzazz. I brought us back down to reality. Dave took us to lofty heights of thinking and broad metaphysical thoughts.
It's hard to not do with a topic like absolutes.
It is. I tried, people. I tried to bring it back down. I think we did a good job, Dave.
I think we put the cookies on the bottom shelf just enough for everybody. So we didn't get
lost.
That
was a nice practical metaphor. Thanks for closing on that note.
Thank you. And now let's go get cookies.
Oh, it sounds good. Bye, guys.
Bye. Life's not a sequence program from the sky, but it's a story. If you have questions, you can email us at podcast@morethanthis.site. You can also leave comments on the show entry at facebook.com/morethanthispod.